Du lytter til Hestedyrlærerne, podcasten til dig, der er dyrlæge eller veterinærsygeplejerske og arbejder med heste. Mit navn er Gorm Carson, jeg er dyrlæge og arbejder som konsulent for Boehringer Ingelheim i Danmark. I Hestedyrlærerne taler vi om tilstande og sygdomme, der kan påvirke heste, men vi dækker også andre emner, der er relevante for dig, der arbejder med hestesundhed. Denne podcast er lavet af Boehringer Ingelheim, og vi ønsker hermed at give noget tilbage til dig, der arbejder med hestesundhed. Vi vil gerne dække emner, der er både interessante og relevante for dig. Og har du forslag til nye emner, du gerne vil høre om, eller har du tips til en spændende gæst, vil vi gerne høre fra dig. Du kan finde kontaktoplysningerne i podcastbeskrivelsen.
Welcome to Hestveterinärerna, Hestedyrlägarna, or just the Equine Vets. This podcast is, as you may know, produced by Boehringer Ingelheim, and more specifically, the equine team in the Nordics. If you are working as a vet or a vet nurse in Sweden, Norway, or Denmark, you will most likely have met us, or at least one of our excellent key account managers, at one point or another. All our team members are dedicated equine experts, and they also have profound knowledge about not only our products, but also great skills and knowledge about the equine industry and veterinary medicine. And we're very happy to hear from you, should you have any questions or concerns about our products or disease areas. My name is Maria Willemsson, and I am a brand manager here at Boehringer Ingelheim. And in the following episodes, you will be hearing me and my colleague Louise Husted-Larsen, who is brand and technical manager. And we're going to talk to you about equine gastric ulcer syndrome, a topic that will never run out of fashion. But we will start by telling you a bit about our backgrounds. So for myself, I'm a veterinary nurse by training. And on top of that, I have a master's degree in equine science, in which equine nutrition is my specialty. And naturally, agus is a topic that I care a lot for. And you, Louise, why don't you tell us about your background and research?
Yes, hi, Maria. Thank you very much. My background is I'm a veterinarian, graduated from 2004, and I've always found internal medicine very, very interesting and exciting. So through my career, I pursued some specialty training in this. And amongst that, I performed a PhD study on specifically gastric ulcers. On top of that, I succeeded in becoming a diplomat of the American College of Veterinary Internal Medicine in large animal. And this is how my career has taken me all over the world, working in various countries, specifically or mostly in the United States, as well as here in Scandinavia and Denmark. And for the past year, I also visited the Middle East. So I worked in Saudi Arabia for a year, working with mostly Arabian horses, but also thoroughbreds. So I've been around here and there and seen a variety of different horses in a variety of training situations. So,
yeah, I was going to come to that. You must have seen lots of different sort of patient populations as well. What is the most striking difference between those parts of the world that you've been in?
Well, working in Denmark, I think a lot of owners here know a lot of things about horse disease. And I can feel that working with a lot of people here in Scandinavia and Norway and Sweden, it's the same. So owners know a lot. When I worked in the United States, it is very different. You could have owners that knew a lot of things about nutrition, health care of the horse and everything else. But we were also in situations where we were rural and not a lot of veterinary assistants were there or knowledge. So the communication could be a little bit on a different level. And in the Middle East, communication or language barrier was there. So it was mostly communication by body language and trying to understand each other. But a common thing for all of these horse owners were that they really wanted the best health for their horse, of course. So we were all working towards the same goal, no matter what country we were in. Mm.
We're going to be talking about agus, and this is, as you said, a specialty of yours, or what you did your PhD on.
So the first thing I would like to ask you is, when do you suspect aegis? If we look at it from the field veterinarian's perspective or the general practitioner's perspective, you get a call from an owner and they start to tell you what's going on with their horse. What's the first thing that makes it ring a bell in your head? This is probably aegis that we're dealing with.
Yeah, it's very interesting question, because aegis can present its way in so many ways. But with all the horses that I have met and diagnosed with gastric ulcers, if I come across a horse that has a behavior where it goes back and forth to its crib feed, that it's very slow at eating and it's kind of going back and forth, maybe displaying a little bit of pain, like a pain response, pawing a little bit while it's eating its crib feed. That's one of the things that makes me want to examine at least what's going on in the stomach. It's not necessarily gastric ulcers. It can be other things. But the fact that it's going back and forth to the crib and showing a little bit of discomfort, maybe not colic, but discomfort is a softer word of mild pain, is one of those things where I start thinking in that direction. Of course, you have to look at what's going on in the mouth and the esophagus and everything else, but that's one of the key thing. Now, a lot of people, I think colic is one of the big things, like active colic. And I want to say that usually if I have active colic, like severe colic, the gastric ulcers are not necessarily the primary problem. You might be able to find ulcers because the horse might have eaten in a not so regular fashion. It has had some disruption in its eating pattern due to whatever else caused the colic. But overt colic, like severe colic, is rarely the exact cause, or is not often caused by ulcers. It's kind of a secondary problem. So it's more subtle symptoms that I find that these gastric ulcers horses have. It can be very sensitive skin when you put your saddle on, when you tighten the girth, when you brush it along the sides, behavior changes. It's more subtle symptoms, I think, is more the classic thing for gastric ulcers than overt severe pain, in my opinion.
But do you think all of these sort of symptoms needs to be present? Or, for example, the girth thing is something that you hear quite a lot, that it's a common symptom. But if that's the only thing that the horse is presenting, would that still make you think aegis? Let's say if it's in the clinic for something orthopedic or something else not related to gastrointestinal issues, and then the owner just pops out there, yeah, it's pretty girthy. Yeah. Is that something that makes you want to think aegis as well, or does it need to have more symptoms showing?
Yeah. With aegis, I always want to have the whole history. Yeah. You know, I want the kind of the specific on the horse, the signalment of the horse. I want to know the horse a little bit better, and for that, the owner's perception of their horse is key. So just having one single symptom will tell me nothing. I have to have more pieces of the puzzle before I really want to go that way. But it's definitely one of those that will make me think in the direction and then start asking the owner other questions about other symptoms, about how the horse is in general, behavior-wise. Of course, the age of the horse can mean something as well. Changes in the environment, changes in management in general. So all those little things needs to add up before I go the gastroscopy way to see if we truly have ulcers or not. Because the danger is if I only take that single symptom and I choose to scope the horse without actually hearing the rest of the story, I find the ulcers, and then I automatically will say, okay, the ulcers are causing the symptoms. But what if it's not those ulcers that's causing the symptoms? Maybe there's something else, exactly like an orthopedic disease or something else, and whatever I see in the stomach is secondary to that. Then I haven't done my job properly. I haven't found the primary cause for these lesions in the stomach. So because I cannot ask the horse itself, I need to ask the owner, and the owner needs to translate whatever she or he sees on the horse at home. And I need to be open to hearing the story and the interpretation from the owner to make the correct diagnosis.
You mentioned that horse owners in the Nordic countries are pretty aware of different diseases, and they know quite a lot of theory behind illnesses and so on. And maybe that's a difference from country to country, but would you say it's more common that a horse owner will call you and say, I think my horse have gastric ulcers, I want to be examined for this? Or would you say it's more common that they would call and say, my horse is acting strangely, there's something wrong with it, I don't know what it is, and then it's sort of your job to find whatever's causing it? You know what I mean?
Yes.
That they're pointing in that direction?
Yes.
Or
yeah,
more open.
It is because gastric ulcers have become such a popular diagnosis, or you can say that a lot of horse owners know about gastric ulcers.
Yeah, there's a lot of awareness.
Exactly, yeah. Awareness is very, very high. Then if you go online and read about gastric ulcers and the symptoms that comes with that, you can almost have any horse having any kind of symptom, on paper, have all the hallmarks for gastric ulcers. So of course, horse owners will think that of course this will be gastric ulcers, and that would be the most important diagnostic test to have performed. But in my opinion, it is so important to step back and listen to more information before making the decision of doing a gastroscopy. Fortunately, the gastroscopy in itself is a pretty benign procedure, but it does take some preparation, and of course some you can't just scope a horse walking through the door. You have to have it prepared with fasting and so forth. So it really needs to be that you listen to the whole story and get all the information before you make an assumption of what could be the correct diagnostic test for that particular horse. So I think the most important thing for younger veterinarians is to, when horse owners approach you and they say that I think my horse truly has gastric ulcers, to remain open.
Yeah.
Listen to what they say. Don't just ignore the fact that it might have gastric ulcers, but be very open-minded and remember that gastric ulcers can look just like just about any other diagnosis as well. So you have to really use your knowledge, your veterinary knowledge, and put the piece of the puzzles together.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. As we talked about, it can be quite tricky to detect for vets and horse owners alike. And we talked about symptoms, but sometimes there just are no symptoms, or they're very vague or diffuse. What would you say are the more uncommon signs, ones that people might not even consider gastric ulcers, but it's still shows to have it, or you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I think a big one is the behavior change, something where the horse is changing its attitude. It either becomes more quiet and unwilling to work, or it becomes aggressive, which is one of the signs of pain. And horses are very much like humans. We're very individual in the way that we perceive pain and our reaction to pain. And remember that gastric ulcers are not like an acute type of pain. It's more like a chronic, low-grade pain. Humans that have this this disease will also describe that it's like a constant, just a lurking presence of pain.
Or discomfort, as you
mentioned. Discomfort,
it.
Yes. Yeah, not like a sharp pain, but a discomfort that's chronic. Mm. And that will change your energy level, your mood, your willingness to learn new things. Maybe it's not where you think that the horse, you can't pick out that the horse is having a severe problem, like you would take it to the vet right away. But there's just something that slowly, gradually changes into something abnormal for that particular horse. And sometimes you have horses that change ownership, and it takes a while to get to know your new horse. And then you won't pick up on this for a long time because you don't truly know your horse.
Yeah.
And that's the situation where the veterinarian is in a little bit of a pickle, because they don't know the horse either. Mm-hmm. So that's where the communication becomes a bit tricky. So, yeah.
I myself often find that owners know pretty much what EGIS is. They know sort of the theory and the basics. But as we've been discussing, in reality, it's often a complex condition and you can't really, it's no clear cut or black or white. You can often not always tell whether the horse has it or not. But I imagine that you still get a lot of questions from owners with and without horses with gastric ulcers. What are the most common questions, would you say, that come from horse owners and how do you answer them?
Well, again, the problem with the gastric ulcer syndrome is that we can have so many symptoms. So I've been asked about every symptom under the sun, whether that could be caused by gastric ulcers. And I can never reject that until I get more information from the owner. So a lot of times I think it's riding issues, like the horse is starting to change in the willingness to work. And whether that could be related to gastric ulcers, because if that was the key, scope the horse, find the ulcer, treat the ulcer, and in the owner's mind, that would solve the problem. But unfortunately, I think a lot of the riding issues could be related to the primary cause, like an orthopedic problem, back pain, something else like this. And when I then scope the horse, the ulcers might be secondary. And that's a big, big thing to pick up on, that you don't just treat the ulcer and then oversee the rest of the problem. You have to really search and listen to the story and get the full picture before you decide whether the ulcers are the primary or the secondary problem.
So what are the most common misconceptions around gastric ulcers then from the horse owners? Because I guess you do get some of those as well.
Yes, I do. I think I've scoped enough horses now that I've heard a lot of the stories that leads up to the referral to me for checking if this particular horse has ulcers. And one of the big thing is that certain pressure points on the horse's body will show a response from the horse, indicating that could be a sensitivity that's caused by a gastric ulcer. It's usually in the midline under the girth area, but if you do that to a lot of horses, they will react, and that doesn't mean that they necessarily have an ulcer.
I think most horses would find that uncomfortable.
Exactly. So if you go around and poking with a finger and sticking them here and there, they will react. So that's probably one of the big things, that poking a horse in the stomach or with a finger and putting pressure in certain points and thinking that could be related to ulcers. That's not the case, in my opinion. I've scoped so many horses referred to me with this history, and I would say that it's very rare that I find ulcers in that particular group of horses. So I think I could make a point out of saying that's not accurate. I it's not like I've never seen a horse, but I mean, if you look at the big group of horses, then that would be more the a coincidence rather than a diagnostic, suppose. The other thing that you can talk about a lot is the crib biting behavior with the air sucking.
Yeah.
And that one has been up for some time, whether that's caused by ulcers or whether the cribbing is causing ulcers. So whether it's the chicken or the egg, there's no clear correlation between those two either. So if you treat the horses with some kind of acid-inhibiting medication, they will not stop cribbing. So it's not like that has anything to do with increased sensitivity in the stomach. And there was a study recently that looked at this, where they took a big group of horses that recently started to crib, and they treated those. Of course, they had a control group as well. And they treated those, and there was absolutely no difference. So it was a pretty solid study, and so that correlation is not really there.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I think there was, like, some years ago also an abattoir study where they looked at the mucosa of the stomach in horses, and cribbing horses and non-cribbing horses, and also found no difference.
Right, yes. So
in the histology or the visual,
Yeah. There are other risks by being a cripper, but gastric ulcers does not seem to be one of them.
Yeah. Maybe if you have a horse that is cribbing, it can also have ulcers, and it's the stress that's sort of causing both of them.
Yeah.
But it's not necessarily correlated to each other.
Yeah.
So back to your research, you did a PhD on gastric ulcers. Can you tell us more about that, and what exactly did you look for, and what exactly did you find?
Yes. So I did my research in measuring pH in the stomachs over time in these horses, because we know that the single most important factor that causes ulcer is acid exposure to the mucosa in the stomach. And that goes both in the glandular and the non-glandular part of the stomach. That's kind of the key. If you don't have acid, you don't have an ulcer. That's kind of the working theme in human medicine as well, that the acid is absolutely necessary to cause an ulcer in the first place. The way to get there might be different when you talk about glandular ulcers versus non-glandular, but the acid is the acid exposure is definitely the primary thing when you talk about pathophysiology. So we looked at the pH as a reflection of acid in the stomach. Now, horses are continuous acid producers, so they produce acid all the time, no matter if they eat or not. And that's essentially the problem with our horses. Us, as humans, we are meal-induced acid producers. So every time we eat a meal, we start our acid production, and then it kind of wanes away when we're finished with our meal. But horses, no matter if they're eating or not, they have acid production in their stomach, and their pH is pretty low. pH is around 2 in the glandular part of the stomach. So horses are very dependent on having a roughage coming into the stomach at all times. One thing is to fill up the stomach and have a feed ball mass in there of food. And the other one is the saliva production, which acts as a buffer to this acid. So those two components are essential when you talk about prevention of ulcers. But we looked at the acid, the normal acid variation through 24 hours in horses that are fed constantly. And we were also looking at what happened when we fast the horses with the pH in the stomach. And then we were looking at them when they were in the stall with a companion, when they were in a stall alone, because that's a stress factor, and also when they were in the paddock with a bunch of buddies grazing way outside. So we sort of had a setup where we looked at them 3 days in a row in various conditions. And what we saw confirmed what we had suspicion of already, that horses' eating patterns are very diurnal. That means that they have a lot of eating behavior through the day. And then through the night, they will have like a natural decrease in their intake of roughage. And then they will pick up their eating activity again early in the morning, and then that will go its merry way. And that variation caused a variation that followed that exact pattern when it comes to the pH. So as long as the horse was eating normally and was offered the roughage that it was supposed to eat, produced the saliva, then the pH was high, meaning that we had a good buffering of the acid, everything was fine, and the condition in the stomach was not ulcerogenic, as we call it. And when we came to the late evening and after midnight, when they stopped eating, we could see that there were a natural drop in the pH, nice and slowly down until the early morning, indicating that the stop in eating behavior, the stop of the saliva production, a smaller size of the feed ball inside, decreased the pH a little bit because the acid wasn't buffered as well. But that seems to be a completely natural way of a variation or a cycle in the horse's stomach. But then we also realized that the closer the pH got to 3-4-ish through the morning, that's where if you're not feeding your horse again, and the longer time you have this period with low pH, the more ulcerogenic environment you have in the stomach. So the key is that the horse needs to have access to roughage a good time through the 24 hours to make sure you don't have too long of a period where you have the low pH. So if you have a horse that's fed less than optimal, where it's not fed enough and the feed ball is a little bit too small and it's not producing enough saliva, then you might have a condition where your pH is lower than it should be for a prolonged period of time. Mm. And that's where your risk increases for getting ulcers. So that's what the studies did. That was the kind of the first part of this. The second part was looking for bacteria in the stomach, in the glandular part of the stomach, where we looked specifically for the Helicobacter species. Helicobacter is one bacteria that we know in human beings and other animals is causing ulcers by themselves, so as a primary thing. But in the horse, it did not seem to be the case. We simply could not detect any Helicobacter, which has been confirmed later through several studies. We keep looking for them and we never find them. So It does not seem like Helicobacter specifically is a pathogen for the horse's ulcers in the glandular part of the stomach.
Mm. Something that I found really interesting with your PhD and your research was the picture of the stomach that you had dissected, and you made little holes in it and you could actually see the feed inside of it, and it was packed. I mean, if you are used to looking at horses' stomachs through an endoscope, then they're most often empty. And also, it's like when you talk about it and when you think about it, you sort of seem to think about it as it's a compartment where there's a sort of a soup, you know, or at least you don't think of it as a packed bag full with very compact and pretty well chewed fiber, really. But it was a very interesting. I think it's also sort of an eye opener that we are actually talking about a ball of food and not just a soup or a squishy mess.
No.
And which also makes a lot of sense when it comes to how the protective aspect of the food, how it's actually physically preventing the acid from reaching the mucous membranes in the stomach. So really interesting. And would it be correct to sort of think of it as a sponge, that if it's like smaller and then you have more liquid in relative to mass or the feed ball, then you will have like the sponge effect will sort of squeeze out the juices to all parts of the stomach, sort of. Because I think a lot of people have been explaining it before, like you have a mat of feed. And I think in some people's head, or at least in my head, the image was like, okay, so you have, yeah, like a compartment with fluid, and then there's on top of that, there's sort of a mat that's protecting it. But actually you have a ball, it's kind of like a sponge, but if it's big enough, then it won't be squeezed.
Yeah.
And the liquid won't reach the higher sort of compartment.
I think it's because we think about it as rumen. We always talk about the pH is stratified in the stomach of the horse.
Yeah.
And that's where a lot of us will think about how a rumen, the content of a rumen is stratified as well, with a mat of roughage on the top and then more liquidy in the bottom. And it's nothing like that in a horse. So in the horse, you do have a stratification, but in the center, you have this big feed bowl. And if, for anybody that scoped a horse that hasn't been fasted for long enough, you have said hello to that feed bowl. You can see it. You can see the image there. And just imagine that if you had a horse fasted for not long enough, and you see that roughage bowl in there, imagine that it's 10 times bigger, maybe, and fills up the entire stomach.
Mm.
And that feed ball physically is like a sponge. It sucks in the acid production, but it also layers around it. It gets this mixture with the saliva that's continuously produced. And as I said, they produce acid all the time. So you have a constant production of acid.
Mm.
And that constant production needs to be correlated with the size of the feed ball, so that feed ball can kind of absorb the acid.
Yeah.
Now, if the feed ball starts to get smaller, but you still have the same amount of acid produced, then you have too much fluid compared to your food mass in there.
Mm.
And then you get your problem with your viscosity in general, your your fluid viscosity in there gets more liquidy and free fluid, and that can splash around and reach the top of the stomach, which is the white part that's not as resistant like the glandular part.
Yeah.
So it's all a like a dynamic mix of whatever comes in needs to be able to absorb the acid, and then it slowly gets transported through the duodenum and leaves the stomach, but that needs to be like a circular circle. So if you stop the intake, then your feed bowl becomes too small to absorb your acid, and then you can get into trouble. So so that's how the misconception has always been a little bit the fact that we in our heads we look at it as a stratified rumen content.
Yeah.
But the key is that your pH in your horse stomach do decrease as you go down, but you have to physically take a little part of that feed mass and squeeze the liquid out, and then you can measure your pH. And as you go further into the stomach and squeeze out in the bottom, that will be definitely lower pH than whatever you squeeze up in the top part.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah. So no more thinking about the mat, but thinking about the feed ball.
Correct.
Tak fordi du lyttede til Hestedyrlærerne. Hvis du kan lide, hvad du hører, så læg en anmeldelse i din podcast-app, og glem ikke at fortælle dine venner og kolleger om podcasten, eller del på de sociale medier. Vi vender snart tilbage med endnu et spændende afsnit af Hestedyrlærerne.